And I want to talk today about how to incorporate quantum into what we have seen in different ways. So let's just start out by talking about the classical machine learning methods that we've talked about. So you might remember that we tend to break this down into supervised learning, unsupervised learning, and reinforcement learning, although we didn't talk about reinforcement learning here, except one group gave a nice presentation about reinforcement learning in our tutorial last week. But we haven't talked about this in lectures, so let's kind of leave.
So maybe just for the recording, I'll repeat. So we'll just kind of look at making a kind of outline here of what we've done so far in the course, which has been using classical machine learning methods to help us study many-body systems. So we have supervised learning, unsupervised learning, reinforcement learning, and this one we haven't really talked about in lecture, so we'll kind of leave that bubble there to be expanded elsewhere. But let's kind of talk about what we've seen in terms of supervised learning and unsupervised learning. So does anyone want to help me to build this? What are some methods we've seen in this course? What was your favorite one?
Linear regression.
Linear regression, great. I guess if you're looking at the notes online, you're just going to read it for me. But so linear regression. This is kind of the first supervised learning algorithm we talked about. We did a lecture and a tutorial on this. So we also talked about this briefly in lecture. We talked about this K nearest neighbor algorithm. We didn't really practice using it, but we did kind of briefly outline the steps, so I'll mention that here. And of course, there are many supervised learning algorithms that we didn't have time to study in this course that are useful in many cases and quite fundamental in machine learning. So I want to put these dots to emphasize there's a lot more. Then we talked about for quite a large part of the class, we talked about these fully connected feed-forward neural networks for supervised learning. This is what you used for the first homework. And then we also talked about these convolutional neural networks. And then unsupervised learning, we kind of focused on, here I'll just kind of divide in the type of tasks we talked about. So we talked about dimensional reduction, and this is what homework 2 is focused on. And then Mohammed talked to you a lot about generative modeling. And I know that Juan and Roger will likely talk about generative modeling for at least part of their lectures this week as well. And as I've mentioned before, we're going to expand a lot on that in a PhD course that we're developing next year for those of you that are still around. But this is sort of what we've seen. And let me just say, just to emphasize that maybe we haven't explored an extensive list of everything you could do. So let me just put those dots there to emphasize that. So I just thought this is maybe useful to kind of show you how everything fits together that we've seen so far. Do you guys have any questions about anything we've seen so far? Let me just emphasize, Mohammed talked about a lot of different generative modeling architectures. I'm just kind of summarizing it here. Okay, so today I want to talk about kind of how to incorporate quantum into what we've seen so far. So let me kind of explain the outline for today by making a diagram like this as well. So I don't know if I find this funny. I don't know if you'll find it funny, but initially when I was kind of making an outline for today, I thought I kind of wrote in the outline that the topic of the lecture today was going to be quantum machine learning, but I've actually decided to change it and make it quantum and machine learning. This is a little bit more general, and I hope to kind of explain the difference between what it means to kind of how there's maybe a few different ways to incorporate quantum into machine learning, one of which is quantum machine learning. So the first thing that I want to talk about quite briefly is how we could use some of the same methods we've already seen, but specific applications that include data from quantum systems, some of which we've kind of alluded to briefly, but I'll just kind of give a few more examples there. And then what I want to focus a bit more time on and what we will kind of dive into in tomorrow's tutorial is machine learning that actually processes the training on a quantum device. And so this is usually what people mean when they say quantum machine learning, although you could sometimes see conflicting definitions, but I think most people would agree this is what's meant by quantum machine learning. Any questions so far? Okay. So first, let me tell you about some exciting applications that use machine learning to study quantum systems. And there's a really nice article you can look at for more information that kind of also puts together a lot of relevant recent work in this field. It's written by Juan Carrasquilla, who's giving the lecture tomorrow, as well as Giacomo Torlai, who was a PhD student, and he's now here, and he's now at Amazon. So we have all... So the idea here, I guess, is that we can use classical machine learning methods, many of which we've already talked about in this class, but just specifically applied to quantum many-body systems. So let's give some examples. And let me say, too, that I'm not really mentioning this for the first time because Mohammed already talked about one of these applications in the kind of bonus lecture of his research that he gave last week. So So in our course, we've looked a lot at how we can use machine learning to study phase transitions. And we've been looking at classical systems where we could identify phase transitions, but we could, of course, use some pretty similar methods and study quantum phase transitions. So again, we've looked at phase transitions in classical systems like the Ising model, and we've also talked about this Z2 gauge theory. We could use similar methods or the same methods, and we could study quantum phase transitions, but in this case, the data that's usually taken is a projective measurement that could come from, in our case, we were always looking at data from simulation. There's also studies where they take data from experiment and do similar. We can also talk about quantum state tomography, which also kind of falls within this category. Okay, I think it's fine. Yeah, don't worry. Yeah, thank you so much. So the idea in these kind of problems is that you want to gain some information about the quantum state that you have based on some limited set of measurements that you have. And there are many ways that you can do this. But recently it's been shown that machine learning can help with this. So the idea is that generative models can assume some kind of a structure that has been shown to be useful in producing an efficient representation of your quantum state in these kinds of things. Any questions so far? I know I'm just kind of giving an overview, and again, I think Roger and Juan both are actively researching in all of these applications, so you can definitely ask them about their research, and they might repeat some of these ideas tomorrow as well, but I kind of wanted to set the context of how this fits into what we've seen so far. And the last application I want to mention in this category is using machine learning to help find ground states of systems.
These phase transitions, for example.
Yeah.
From your experience, kind of linking onto what we were discussing last time with using these techniques to actually learn new physics,
mm-hmm.
rather than just reproducing things we know, would you say that in the future it will still remain more like an automation process in the sense that, you know, we could also look at a physical system, the data we get from it,
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, this looks like something I might call ferromagnetic, this
mm-hmm.
looks like paramagnetic,
mm-hmm.
And then, you know, just like be able to read off this critical temperature, let's say,
mm-hmm.
without understanding
right.
why the critical temperature is there. And so I'm just saying automation in the sense that we might be generating a lot of data, and instead of, you know, as a human saying, this is one, this is the other, and going through that process,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's just done by a machine. And we might apply that to new experimental systems.
Mm-hmm.
So do you picture it just being that automation process of like analyzing the data or
mm-hmm.
eventually actually telling us the reason why?
Mm, I see. Yeah. Yeah. So I think, I mean, first of all, this field is still in early stages. So I don't know. I don't want to say I know exactly where it's going to be able to go. But I do think this is one of the goals for sure, is that you want to be able to for sure use it on systems where we don't know the answer. I think this is a goal that we're hoping, you know, maybe right now the field is often focused on developing a toolkit that we're going to be able to apply more widely. But then your question, so that's kind of saying that we want to be able to apply it to systems we haven't studied, which I know isn't your full question. You're then saying, will we also be able to use it to kind of tell us something about the theory that's going on, right? So not just to analyze data faster for us, but to also tell us something. Because I do think the goal is maybe to help us identify if there is a phase transition when maybe we don't know until we look at the data. And that's maybe something that we're working towards being able to do eventually. But it's interesting, like the way you phrased your question is, can it tell us about the theory? And I think that's something more complicated that's a really active area still, is how can we learn something about the underlying physics from the data? Like, how much do we need an expert's input to really understand the predictions of that machine learning algorithm? Like that boundary, I guess, of where that line is between who's kind of providing the major theoretical breakthrough. I don't know exactly how far we're going to be able to push that line. Does anyone else want to ask anything related to that? Would be a great thing to ask in the coming lectures as well. I would be curious to hear what Juan and Roger would have to say based on their experience too. Okay. So let me just emphasize this last one is something that Mohammed kind of alluded to a little bit and showed you some results from his work. So the idea here is that if you were given the Hamiltonian for some quantum many-body system, you can use a generative model to help you approximate the ground state of that system. Okay, so this is really all I wanted to summarize about that kind of first bubble about machine learning that is using classical methods but applied to data that comes from some kind of a quantum system. So now I kind of want to switch to talking about quantum machine learning. And one thing that I find useful is just to know kind of what people mean when they say that. So let me just tell you some other ways you might see it referred to. So sometimes people will call this quantum assisted machine learning or quantum enhanced machine learning. So let me also say there's some really great references to study this. I should acknowledge I wouldn't really consider myself an expert in this field. I've spent some time studying it, but I largely prepared this lecture by reading some of these other references and kind of trying to summarize some ideas that could be useful to fit in with this course. So I would really encourage you, if you're interested in this topic, to further explore some of these references. And also, this is not at all an extensive list of references. These are just ones that I found particularly useful. And I just also want to mention that Maria Schuld, she's a researcher at Xanadu, and she's really great at explaining this field. She has a lot of ideas and insight, and she has a lot of talks online in different formats. So I think she's a great person to look to if you want to learn more. But that being said, I will spend the rest of the lecture kind of trying to summarize some ideas in this area. So, kind of repeating what I said in that bubble in a different way. The goal of this field is really to use quantum computers or devices to help with machine learning tasks. And help can mean, you know, different things. We maybe are talking about speeding up something, or we might also be just talking about providing some innovative new methods to help us with machine learning. So there are different goals you could consider that could fit into this category. Here specifically, we're going to focus on something known as variational circuits. So the goal here is that we want to use some kind of a quantum processing device as a machine learning model that we're going to call a variational circuit. And I want to emphasize that these devices can include near-term devices that are already existing today, not just fault-tolerant quantum computers that haven't been developed yet. So I'm just kind of setting the stage here, but for the rest of this lecture and in tomorrow's tutorial, we're going to be studying these variational circuits. So it turns out that in this class of models, there can be a lot of analogies made with neural networks. So what we're going to be talking about is a class of machine learning models that's going to consist of a quantum circuit, but where there are some parameters in that circuit that can be tuned, and those parameters are going to label as theta. And I'm just curious, how many people have read a little bit about variational circuits before? Okay, a few people. How many people have programmed them in some kind of a library before? Okay, great. So you guys will still have something to learn in the tutorial tomorrow. That's great. Okay. So let's consider that we have some quantum input state that's just all zeros and it consists of n qubits. Then we could consider applying some unitary transformation that depends on some parameters to this state. And I could write this in this quantum circuit notation. Move this up. So I know a lot of you have taken quantum information before, so you would have seen these kind of quantum circuits. How many, just to make sure, how many of you have seen this quantum circuit notation before? Okay, not everyone. Okay, that's great. So no, I'm not assuming that you've seen it, and we're just going to talk about some basics, but if this is not, yeah, please feel free to interrupt me if you have questions. But the idea is that we're going to try to represent this, just taking this equation, we're going to kind of write this as a circuit going from left to right, taking some input, feeding it in, getting some output. You can maybe already see that this kind of looks analogous to a neural network in the sense that we have input on the left, we flow it through, and we get some output. This is not a neural network, but you can see some parallels. And of course, in our discussions of machine learning, we were not looking at cases where we always fed in some input state that was all zeros. So often what will be done to kind of formalize this is kind of split up this U into two separate categories, one of which is kind of preparing your data into the input that you want, and another one that's actually doing the machine learning that depends on tuning some parameters. So, you know, we might want to actually process some specific input that we specify. So, this transformation that I'm going to apply, I can represent it as first something that encodes. The data. And then does the processing of this. So so that's how we would write this in circuit notation. So you can kind of see a connection with the X that we talked about in neural networks, that we ideally want to feed in some X here. So we have to apply some procedure that's going to allow us to feed in the input that we want to study. Any questions? No? Okay. So this might be what we want to do in theory, but in practice, these gates would be very large to implement. So it's actually more common that we'll apply a series of much smaller gates. So just writing what I said in words, often in when we're actually trying to practically implement this, we won't actually look at these big matrices, but we'll decompose them into a series of smaller gates. So let me just say an example. So we may have this matrix W that we want to, or this gate W that we want to implement. And so I'm just drawing an example of what this could look like, that what we're really going to see, and also in the code that we study, we're not going to look at these large gates. We're going to look at a series of gates that act on usually only one or two qubits. Some of them depend on these parameters. Some of them might not depend on any parameters. But we're going to be looking at how can we adjust these parameters theta. And also, you know, some gates could depend on more than one parameter. There's many different ways we could design this, just as there's many different ways we can design a neural network. The way that we choose everything here is all hyperparameters, you know, how we're going to choose these gates, and then the theta are what we're actually going to adjust. And I'm just showing you something that the W could look like. Of course, it could be similar for the S. Any questions? Okay, so let's now kind of connect to some terminology that we've seen when we were talking about neural networks. Let's talk about what the cost function would be. So as we've seen before in neural networks, we're still going to have a cost function that we use within a learning algorithm. In this case, we're going to have to do some kind of a measurement at the end of the circuit in order to be able to have something that we can feed into some algorithm. So I'm going to now go back to this notation where this is kind of just all one big box. And show you that, you know, at the end of the day, we're going to have to do some measurement. This is, in case anyone hasn't seen, this is just notation that's often used to indicate that you're performing some kind of a measurement to observe something at the end of your circuit. Now, a lot of this course, we were talking about these feed-forward neural networks for supervised learning. So let's start there and talk about how we could use this kind of a setup for supervised learning. So let me be specific. So I haven't really used this phrasing before because I didn't really need to in the examples we've looked at, but let's specifically say we want to look at a deterministic supervised learning problem. So for a given input, I want to get a given output. An issue you might think of right away is that these quantum systems are going to have probabilistic behaviors. Even if I kind of do the same procedure with the same x and the same theta, I could get a different measurement at the end of the day. So what do you think we would kind of need to do or consider to get something deterministic out of this circuit? What kind of comes to your mind?
Take averages.
Yeah, exactly. So if we were to do just do this one time, we wouldn't be able to guarantee that we get a unique output. But so we would have to make sure that we repeat things many times. And if we, or in theory, we would call that like taking an expectation value. But yeah, an experiment, it would be averaging. Exactly. Yeah. So in practice, that this might actually be averaging over many measurements, or you know, if, in theory, if I could do this arbitrarily well, I would be taking an expectation value like this, and then this is the function that we would be aiming to fit to our labels. So again, if I don't do some kind of averaging, then the result that I get at the end is not always going to be the same for every x. it could change, but that could still be useful because in many cases, I could have problems where I want to be able to have some kind of a probability distribution coming out of these models. So you might remember that often in unsupervised learning problems, we're trying to fit some kind of a probability distribution. We can also have probabilistic supervised learning problems where maybe we want the probability that you get one label is something, but there's also a probability that you get a different label for some X. We haven't really considered that, but there are places where we could have some kind of a probabilistic supervised learning. So in that case, we wouldn't average in this case. Any questions? Okay, you guys are asking far fewer questions than normal, so I don't know if that means you're confused or that it's just like so obvious that I really don't know.
Can you maybe give an example of a probabilistic problem?
Yeah, so, and we're actually not really going to talk about that here, but let me just tell you what I mean there. So really all I was aiming to say here is that there could be in cases where interpreting something as a probability distribution could be useful. So maybe here what I mean is that the data set we were always looking at cases where for a given X, you always have the same label. You could have cases where, maybe 90% of the time you have label one, but 10% of the time you have label two. There could be data sets like this as well. And then interpreting some kind of a probability distribution at the end could be useful, and it could still be considered supervised learning. And again, I just kind of mentioned that for completeness because I didn't want to say that this can only be useful in unsupervised learning. And within this textbook, they kind of have a section where they explain, these kind of two cases. So I just wanted to be complete here, but we're not actually going to look at this kind of example here.
Is this really that different from tomography? Because I mean, every state can be written as u times zero.
Mm-hmm.
And then you could just be asking the question, like, if I fix some universal gate set, which gates in that set do I need to get the corresponding?
Yeah, yeah, there are parallels for sure. So definitely, this kind of setup could be used for a tomography purpose. Like it's off, like, you know, if we're interpreting it as a probability distribution, it's often used for generative modeling. I guess what I was saying earlier is that there are many cases where people will use just classical models as well. And sometimes those classical models will be kind of inspired by something quantum, like tensor networks is a whole field where people design these still classical algorithms, but maybe the structure of them is somehow inspired in some quantum way. And here it's specifically something that you could actually run on a quantum device. But yeah, absolutely, you could use it for that purpose. That's a great question. Okay, so we've talked about kind of the cost function that we would have. Let's talk about training briefly. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to find the parameters theta that are going to minimize the cost. And this is similar or analogous to finding the weights and biases in our neural networks. So the way that we're going to update parameters is going to be based around a learning algorithm like gradient descent, or again, you know, some variation on gradient descent. So that part is, again, analogous to neural networks. However, and again, these are big topics that, you know, could be entire lectures or multiple lectures in themselves. So I'm just going to mention a few terms that tend to come up when you're talking about specifically computing gradients in these quantum circuits. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Averaging over many measurements, would you say that that's comparable to like the epoch parameter?
Oh, like how many you average over? Interesting. No, I don't think so. I think it's more comparable, actually. You know, in gradient descent, we talked about stochastic gradient descent, and we talked about using an entire batch versus a mini batch. I would see it as being more comparable to that. I mean, it's not even quite the same still. But in both of those cases, we were kind of averaging some results to get a cost function. In that case, we were averaging over a bunch of data in stochastic gradient descent, some subset of our data, and we would control how much we would look at. Here, we would also be controlling how many results we average over. Epochs are still how many steps of gradient descent we perform.
Right, okay, yeah, because that's still the training
model. So again, I don't expect this to be totally clear, but I think it's kind of useful to introduce some terminology that tends to come up just so you kind of have a context for where this fits in. And I'm happy to talk to people if they want to know or refer you to other references. These books I mentioned, that book I mentioned at the beginning is going to have entire sections on this, but you, in your homework one, you showed how to derive these formulas to calculate gradients that are needed in the cost function to update all of our parameters, specifically for these feed-forward neural networks. So when we're doing that in this case, it turns out we need to, you know, come up with some new ways of doing this. So people can use finite difference methods, something that people also often use, and that's often a better way to do things is these parameter shift rules. But actually, this is a very active area of research, and these rules are still not very efficient. They don't scale very well. So this is something people are still actively trying to understand and work on. So this next point is something we would always have to be aware of when we're running these kind of algorithms, but it tends to be a problem that comes up a lot when training these quantum variational circuits, which is something known as Baran plateaus. These are areas in your parameter space where all of your gradients become very close to zero. And in that case, it's just very difficult to make progress in your learning algorithm. So finding ways to deal with these and recognize them, it's another active area of research.
How is that different from, like, why couldn't you use momentum or something like this?
Yeah, so I don't know so much about it. That's definitely something that we use to combat those kinds of problems, for sure. I don't know so much about exactly what they do here. Probably something like this is definitely useful in these kinds of areas, but I just wanted to make people aware that this tends to be a big problem that people run into a lot in these kinds of algorithms. But that's definitely something that tends to help when that comes up. So again, just to repeat something I've said before, is that this is a very active area of research where people are still working hard to try to gain more insights. So let me just, in 2 minutes, just tell you very briefly what we're going to look at in tutorial, which is going to be actually coding some of these models. So there are several different libraries you can use to study these types of models and train them. Specifically, in tomorrow's tutorial, we're going to use this Penny Lane library. And actually, it still will make use of other machine learning libraries within this. So for us, we've been using PyTorch within this course. So in our tutorial, we'll use a combination of Penny Lane and PyTorch. And let me just emphasize one final point, which is, where does the device come in? Where does the quantum device come in? Because of course, you guys are going to run this on your classical laptop tomorrow. So let me just emphasize that. So again, this is something that you're going to see explicitly. But what's really neat about these libraries is that you kind of have one line of your code that says, what device do I want to run this code on? And for us, it's going to be just a quantum simulator. But if you had access to a quantum device, you could just replace that line of your code and run it on a quantum hardware device, which I think is really cool. So again, this is something that I think will become more clear in the tutorial, and we'll talk a little bit more about a specific problem and how we train it using some of these libraries. You guys have any questions?
I'm just wondering where, like, the quantum advantage kind of lies in. Like, is the unitary just some special you know, something that you simply could not implement via layers of neural networks?
Yeah, so first of all, I think that's a really open question. So in a lot of these references, they talk a lot about how people are wanting to look for that right away. And it's, I think it's still open exactly where the quantum advantages come in. But I guess the idea is that, let me just think about how I want to say that distinctly. We're really trying to design an algorithm around something that we can implement today on only a few qubits and then see what kind of results we can get out of that. There's a whole other field of research that could maybe still fall in this category, which I didn't really talk about today, which is kind of how could I maybe get quantum advantage eventually once I have a full fault-tolerant quantum computer. And this area is kind of what can I do more with devices of only a few qubits that I might already have access to today. Yeah?
Just following up on that, I'm still confused how this is like quantum machine learning, because aren't we still using classical algorithms just on the output data of a quantum computer?
So we would be processing, yeah, I see what you're saying. So yeah, I guess the idea is that we would be writing some of the code on a classical computer, but actually processing the data and getting our output from a quantum device. Yeah, so those things can come in different amounts, depending on which kind of subfield of quantum machine learning that you're looking at. But here, that's where the quantum part comes in.
So we're using the classical algorithm to sort of tune our quantum computer so that it's doing exactly what we want it to do. Like,
yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And would be that maybe the way the quantum computer is generating that distribution is just exponentially faster than any classical computer.
Yeah, that's what we would like to have. Yeah, mm-hmm. But again, that's not the only way it can be used. That's just this specific. Yeah. Any other questions? Okay, guys. See you tomorrow.